Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Godchild, a Jack Marconi thriller, by Vincent Zandri, narrated by Joe Hempel. The Land Rover headlights drill through the early morning desert darkness. Two fiery eyes burning on the silent horizon barely an hour before the sun rises over Monterey. 4 a.m. The appointed time. She's been waiting for them, per instructions from her L.A. contact. The halogen signal promised just last night in Houston, when finally, over caviar, Dom, and cocaine, she signed on to do the deal. Her first and last, although that last bit will remain her little secret. She is a writer by trade, but this morning she is more like an actor, playing the role of the burier. A border burier, a bastardization of burrow and courier, all packaged nice and neat in the guise of a beautiful woman. For the sake of the assignment, she has assumed the role of the in-between girl, the paid runner who takes the risk not just for the money, but for the sheer thrill. That's burier, not courier. In the border world between Texas and Mexico, there's a distinct difference. For the burier, it's not about the need to run drugs. It's about the want. Technically speaking, she doesn't need the money. According to her phony bio, she doesn't have a family to feed, a brood of shoeless children living in a one-room shack with no hot water and no father to help carry the weight. What she's supposedly got instead is a two-bedroom townhouse in the Hollywood Hills, a loft apartment in Manhattan's Tribeca, a six-figure modeling contract with the Ford agency, and a $200-a-day coke habit. But all this is not enough. As a burier, she can savor the elation of slipping into a skin-tight leather jumpsuit and motorcycle boots, the sheer power of firing up a Suzuki GSX 1300 Hayabusa equipped with leather saddlebags and a CD-stereo combo with enough lethal amperage to scare off even the most rabid coyote. The burriers are as beautiful as they are dangerous, and they are the only gringos the brothers will deal with these days. Their philosophy? Why eat bread when you can have pure honey? Her philosophy? What a story this is gonna make. She may be acting out a role, but the one thing she can't fake is her beauty. She is, as they say, drop-dead gorgeous, standing out there in the middle of the desert with cropped auburn hair, blue eyes, and black leather jumpsuit, the zipper running from breasts to navel, like something out of a Bond film. And right now, as the headlights shine in the near distance, she can feel her heart beating, her throat closing, that little tingle shooting up her spine telling her, "It's time, baby." The desert is peaceful this morning, calm. There is a sweet, dry desert smell, and a slight hum that comes from the insects you never see in the dark of night. There is the bone cold, and the occasional burst of wind to make it even colder, to send the fine granules of sand up into her face, make them stick to the red lipstick that covers her heart-shaped mouth. When the doors on the Land Rover suddenly open, one at a time, and the silhouettes of two men appear, one tall and thin, the other short and stocky, both packing shotguns, she knows she's reached the proverbial point of no return. No amount of acting can stop those bullets should they start to fly. She cannot deny the fear any more than she can deny the thrill of it all. She's the method writer, after all. She's not interested in facts so much as discovering what it actually feels like to experience something. What are the specific sights, sounds, tastes, and emotions that come together to create an experience? How do you translate these sensations and dimensions to the page so that the experience becomes more real for the reader than if the reader actually participated in it? That's method writing, and there isn't a soul on earth who can come close to her ability to convey a true life and death experience. Now, with every step they take toward her, with every shell they cock into the metal chambers of their pump-action shotguns, she knows she is coming that much closer to death. The real thing. So she rubs her hip up against the saddlebag, just to make certain that the money and her life is still a viable option. Because if the money is not there, she knows she has no choice but to hand over her life. No questions asked, no excuses, no, oh crap, I left it on the kitchen counter. No begging, no pleading, no free sex. She's done the research, so she knows what these brothers are capable of, even on a good day. How they strip you, strap you down naked on your back, all four limbs tied to stakes, baby oil poured over the skin, the hair on your head and sex completely shaved, eyelids taped back against your eyebrows so that when the desert sun also rises, the eyeballs fry while your skin bubbles and broils. What they find of you later, if they find you at all, stands as a coyote-chewed warning, a fleshless message not to fuck with the Contreras brothers and their Mexicali turf. But this morning, she has nothing to worry about, as the two men in cowboy boots and Stetsons close the gap. She can feel the bulge that the cash makes in the saddlebag when her thigh contacts it. The sensation is oddly sexual. She swallows hard when the two men stop dead in their tracks, as though on cue. Obviously, they've been through the routine dozens of times before. One of the men, the shorter, takes four or five steps forward, meets her face to face, so close she can smell the tequila and cigarettes on his breath.
Buenos días, señorita.
It's still nighttime, in case you hadn't noticed.
Did you bring our money?
Did you bring our drugs?
Oh, I like that. A beautiful woman who answers a simple question with a stupid question makes my job so much easier.
Shall we get down to the job, or shall we stand around and chat?
Well, what do you know? Beauty, brains, and, if you'll excuse the expression, balls.
He reaches out with his free hand, uses his dirty fingers to pull down her zipper. As much as his touch repulses her, she allows him to do it, because it's all part of the act, a small price to pay for the method writer. And it proceeds like that. She standing there, he breathing on her, touching her, while his partner looks on in horny amazement. Until business must be tended to, and the saddlebag is opened to reveal its cargo of cash, and then the tailgate on the Land Rover is opened to reveal its payload. As the sun begins to show itself red-orange on the easternmost horizon, the whole deal goes down smoothly. That is, until another set of headlights appears. And another, and yet another. The bright white lights clearly visible a split second before the trio hears the telltale wail of the sirens. Part 1. Remains hint at horror in Mexico. Monterrey, Mexico, AP. U.S. and Mexican authorities have resumed their search for bodies in the desert, where at least six corpses have been unearthed. FBI informants claim as many as 300 victims of a powerful drug cartel could be buried in the desert country between the city and the Texas border. Forensics experts, in cooperation with Mexican soldiers and ski-masked police, have been systematically searching the vast area, as well as two known desert ranches in Monterrey, once the undisputed territory of the Contreras drug cartel, at one time Mexico's most powerful and most violent drug-smuggling family. 1. I was sitting inside Bill's Bar and Grill in Albany, New York, listening to the hard wind that whistled through the cracks in the picture window embedded in the brick wall behind my back. The one held together with duct tape and striped neon piping that spelled out Bud Light and Rolling Rock. I had been kidding myself all afternoon, thinking it was possible to make myself invisible by hoarding a stool in the far, dark corner of the South End bar, all dressed up like a clown in my wedding day blazer, charcoal pants, and virgin loafers with tassels. It was March 21st, according to the folded newspaper that sat ignored on the bar beside my right elbow. Remains hint at horror in Mexico. It was supposed to be one of the happiest days of my life, but I never made the ceremony. That made it one of the saddest. Instead, I'd been hiding out in the corner of this old bar, counting down the minutes until the happy hour crowd left me alone and Bill the bartender dimmed the lights to make ready for some serious drinking. Serious disappearing. If only vanishing were possible. Horror in Mexico, the world's business. The blues in Albany, my business. After 5 slow hours inside Bill's, I could tell you exactly who came and went like clockwork. An old man who called himself Kenny P.C. P for pretty, he slurred, a toothy vampire smile on his ruddy face. C for cute. And dressed himself in blue polyester slacks, a matching blue jacket, and a white rayon shirt. A man far older than his years, he sat 5 stools away from me toward the middle of the bar and drank bottom-shelf scotch, until the head bob began, and the space between the bar and his forehead became narrower and narrower, until the bets were placed for which one final bob would send his skull bouncing off the hardwood, at which time he was escorted to the door, stage right, a taxi already warmed up and waiting for him just outside the picture window. Then there was the woman in cheap Sears jeans and white cotton t-shirt who'd come in sometime around 1:30. She had a pockmarked face and frizzy gray hair. She smoked Pall Mall 100s, one off the other, and carried one hell of a conversation with herself in a South Albany accent. On 3 separate occasions, she found her way over to me, set her hand on my thigh, told me how sad and lonely I looked, and then offered me her body. All 3 times I told her no. Finally, I flipped her a 20 from my honeymoon bankroll just to shut her up. Maybe I liked being lonely, I told her. And then there was the young Mohawk Indian kid who sat 4 stools down from me, whose hands shook so bad he had to use them both to lift his whiskey glass off the bar, bring the rim to his thick lips. I'd gotten to know them all during my disappearing act at Bill's. I had no way of knowing if my fiancée, Val Antonelli, or my best man and lawyer, Tony Angelino, had attempted to contact me. No idea if they wanted to contact me. As I removed the pinned carnation from my breast pocket and set it down on the bar, I knew that by now I had to have been recognized, that I wasn't invisible. And if I had been recognized, then I was also sure that Val and Tony knew exactly where to find me. I blamed the Albany cops. Maybe I had no idea what their names were or what precinct they worked out of, although Albany wasn't that big. But as a former maximum security warden, I'd had gained enough experience over the years to be able to sniff out a cop at 20 paces. It was never the uniform that gave them away. No cop would dare enter this or any other bar for a drink dressed in his on-duty blacks. The cops who came into Bill's were almost always young, almost always dressed in generous-cut Levi's jeans, immaculate running shoes, maybe a pastel-colored polo shirt or Notre Dame sweatshirt pulled over broad, iron-pumped shoulders. They wore gold Irish clotter rings on their middle fingers, and their flat-top hair always had that wet, just-out-of-the-gang shower look. And man, talk about the overwhelming aroma of aqua velva. But if all this were not enough to convince me that the young dude ordering a pint of half-and-half was one of Albany's Irish finest, then I could be certain when he wrapped his arm around Kenny PC's shoulder and addressed the drunk by his first name. Naturally, Kenny would ask the cop if he could spare a couple of bucks. But then the cop would pull out the empty pockets of his jeans, allow them to hang there like little white wings. He'd hold his hands in the air and say, "Kenny, even Jesus Christ himself could touch only so many lepers." You could always spot a cop at Bill's Bar and Grill, because everybody knew cops drank for free. As a former lawman, I knew that the cops must have come and gone immediately after the 8-to-4 shift or right after the 4-to-midnight action shift, just in time for last call. I'd seen quite a few of them during my afternoon inside the bar. Maybe I'd gone a little out of my mind by then, but I knew they spotted me just as easily as I spotted them. I also knew that it was only a matter of time until one of them placed a call to Tony's downtown law practice to let him know where the hell I was. Tony, in turn, would tell Val. On the other hand, why should she waste her time looking for me? Why even make an effort? I was the one who had left her standing at the altar all alone. I was the one who, for 5 long hours, had been pissing away our honeymoon money on beer, whiskey, and regrets. The wind whistled. Even with my blazer on, I could feel the cold March air on my back. I sipped beer from a long-neck bottle, fired up a smoke, and for the 100th time that afternoon hit the playback button in my brain. It had just started snowing as I'd passed the stone pilasters marking Albany Rural Cemetery's south side entrance. Snowing hard in mid-March, I had pushed on past the old iron gates, feeling stiff and cold in the brand-new wedding-day blazer and loafers, shuffling toward the plot that had been home to my first wife, Fran, for almost 3 years now. As usual, I was running late. In less than 15 minutes, my best man would require my presence in the brick rectory behind St. Mary's Cathedral on Eagle Street. According to tradition, Tony and I were expected to sweat it out in that back room among the spare chalices, bags of communion wafers, and the same Boone's Farm wine I used to sneak sips from back when I was still an altar boy. Sweat it out amid the smell of burning candles and incense, until my fiancée and former Greenhaven prison secretary, Val Antonelli, began her long, slow march down the church aisle on her way to a second marriage. Hers and mine. In my right hand, collecting snowflakes, a weightless bundle of wildflowers wrapped in baby blue tissue paper. Under my left arm, hidden by the blue blazer, a leather shoulder holster that cradled a 2.5-pound Colt 45. The low midday clouds showered the sloping landscape in wet snow. The white stuff came down fast and furiously as it fell against the crooked, leafless branches of the trees, against the bleached marble headstones and miniature church-like mausoleums. I stood over the 5x10 plot with the granite marker at its head inscribed with Fran's birth and death dates. Setting the bundle of wildflowers on the plot, I watched the petals begin to disappear in the falling snow. What I saw was a battered black 4-door Buick sedan with tinted windows slamming directly into the passenger side of my Ford Bronco at 50 miles per hour. Fran's head and shoulders going through the windshield, the jagged edge of the glass taking her head clean off as though it were a razor blade. Her body slumping back into the seat like nothing at all had happened, like her life hadn't slipped away in the split second of time it took for that windshield to shatter. Then the screaming of the witnesses, and the spattered blood and the sight of that black Buick tearing away. But not before the driver rolled down his window, just long enough for me to get a good look at his bald head, hoop earring, and the thin mustache that covered only half of his upper lip. The bald man. I stood in the falling snow and I recalled the 2 full years I'd spent in search of the bald man, only to come up empty. There were the endless hours spent sifting through mugshots, photographic kits, evidence folders, and case files. There were the posters printed with the bald man's likeness, the likeness I viewed for only a split second but committed to memory, that I stapled to telephone poles all across the state. There was the $10,000 reward offered for any verifiable information leading to his whereabouts. The entire 2-year effort now resided in my brain, neatly categorized under failure, with a capital F. I knew that with my marriage to Val only a few minutes away, I had no choice but to once and for all give up the search for good. Call it another unsolved mystery, just like the Albany cops did less than a year ago. All that was left was to move on with my life. Remember Fran the way she had lived. I stepped away from the plot. The wildflowers were gone now, completely covered over. I had barely 10 minutes left to make it, you guessed it, to the church on time. 10 minutes to put the past behind me for good. I might have made it, too, if it hadn't been for the battered black Buick sedan that drove in through the cemetery gates. It was the car I remembered, the car that rammed into my Ford Bronco, sending Fran to her death. The Buick. My black Buick with the tinted windows, just sitting there idling, the engine running, exhaust smoking out of the rusted tailpipe gray-black in the falling snow. Here's what I should have done. Pulled out my 45, blasted a couple of rounds over the roof of the car, or maybe blown out a rear tire. But here's what I did instead. Not a goddamn thing. I just stood there, as stuck to the ground as Fran's marker, while the driver of the Buick backed up, spun the front end around, and drove back out the same way he'd come in. Some time went by before I was able to move. I wasn't sure how much time. Seconds, maybe. Or minutes. Time was relative. It was hard to read. But at some point, I forced myself up off my knees, made my way back to my 4Runner through the snow and ice to place a call to the APD, South Pearl Street Division, the precinct that had originally spearheaded Fran's hit and run. I sat inside the SUV drinking sweet whiskey from the emergency fifth I kept in the glove box, fighting off the tremors, waiting for the cops to arrive, knowing I should have been calling St. Mary's Rectory to explain what had happened, explain why I hadn't shown up yet for my own wedding. But there was no explaining anything. I just sat there, watching the snow fall, drinking from the bottle, feeling my body shake and my brain buzz. It was all I could do to swallow the whiskey without bringing it back up. And that was that. By the time the cops pulled up, I was already 10 minutes late for the ceremony. The two black and whites that parked outside the cemetery gates made me think of the black and white taffeta gowns Val had chosen for her bridesmaids to wear. I pictured the dark blazers and white button-downs my best man and ushers were wearing at that very moment. I imagined their blank expressions and their wide eyes staring into watch faces that didn't lie. From where I sat, shivering inside the 4Runner with the heat blasting against my wet shirt, I saw the small beads of sweat that had begun to form on their foreheads when the guests who had filled the church pews started whispering to one another, "I'll be damned, Keeper's not coming." It was the tinny drone of a cop radio that broke the spell as a tall, black-haired detective by the name of Ryan tapped on my windshield. Ryan claimed he was a new guy, having just been transferred from the New York State Office of General Services to South Pearl Street's Behavioral Sciences Unit. Together, we walked to the spot where I'd seen the black Buick. Wearing a leather car jacket with wide epaulettes and buttons, this 30-something Detective Ryan checked my PI license along with my laminated permit for carrying a concealed weapon. He then questioned me calmly and methodically while we walked, sometimes asking and re-asking the same question 2 and 3 times to check for accuracy and consistency of testimony. But then, sometimes cops forget that former wardens know as much about due process as they do. It all went as smoothly as something like that can on a snowy day in March. That is, until we came to the spot near Fran's grave where I'd first seen the Buick. The problem, if you want to call it that, was that no sign of the Buick remained. The ruts that its tires had made when it peeled out were gone, wiped smooth by the still-falling snow. Or, in the words of Detective Ryan, "Just maybe, Mr. Marconi, the tire tracks, along with the Buick, were never there to begin with." "The snow," I insisted. "It must have covered the tracks." I slipped and skidded my way to Fran's plot. I dug my hand through the snow. I pulled up the bouquet of wildflowers, shook them off. "I'm not imagining these," I said. Ryan stood there, studying the white flakes collecting on the tops of his black lace-up shoes. He let out a resigned breath. "You're that ex-warden," he said. "You lost your wife some years back. I've been over the file at division." "Hit and run," I said. "And you're getting married again, is that it?" I was missing the wedding as he spoke. "You came back here out of guilt." "What's your point?" I asked. "Maybe you imagined the Buick." I dropped the flowers. "All I'm saying," he went on, "is that in times of emotional stress and turmoil, it's only natural to imagine things, especially in a spooky place like this." He pinched closed his leather collar, cocked his head in the direction of the gates. I took a couple of steps toward him. "Is this what a behavioral science cop is supposed to do?" I asked. "Convince me of what I didn't see?" He walked up to me, brought his face to within inches of my own, sniffed me up and down with his nose, like a police dog. I knew he could smell the whiskey on my breath. Because he could smell the whiskey on my breath, I knew exactly what he was thinking, although neither one of us said anything about it. In fact, the D word never came up, not even in passing. I cleared my throat. I took a couple of shots, I said, you know, to ease the jitters. After I saw the Buick. But I could tell by the furrows in his brow that he didn't believe me. Tell you what, he said finally, his gray breath mixing with the snow. I'll have an officer take down your testimony. And if we see a black Buick matching the description, we'll pull it over, question the driver. How's that sound? Don't go out of your way, I said. Call it a courtesy, Mr. Marconi, he said. One lawman to another. Back at the south side gates, he called over another plainclothes cop to take my statement. As promised, one lawman to another. A beefy cop dressed in uniform blacks asked if I got a good look at the supposed black Buick in question. Enough to create a composite image, that is. He was trying so hard to hold back the laughs that he was making little raspberry noises through clenched lips. When I finished with my description of the Buick, I made my way back to Ryan. Sorry I wasted your time, I said as he was about to get back inside the cruiser. I was standing right beside him, the passenger side door to the cruiser wide open, his left foot already inside, a wave of hot air blowing out of the dashboard heater onto my legs. You did the right thing, he said, taking hold of my forearm, giving it a sympathetic squeeze as though the cops were still my fraternal cousins in arms. Go get married, he said with a grin. He got in and closed the car door, smiling at me through the lightly fogged glass. But it was way too late to get married, in more ways than one. As I walked slowly back to my forerunner, I couldn't help but look into the faces of each cop as I passed them, one by stinking one. I couldn't help but pick up on the way they whispered in one another's ears, thinking I had to be out of earshot when they referred to me as one paranoid bastard. That's what I remembered. The rest was either repressed or just a dream. Or both. I wasn't sure how long he'd been staring at me. Christ, I wasn't sure how long the entire crowd had been staring at me. But when I came out of my trance, Bill the bartender was standing across from me, his chubby face somehow tight, his receding hair slicked back, his customary white bar rag slung over his right shoulder.
You okay?
He asked me. My hands were wrapped tightly around the empty beer bottle to keep them from shaking. The bottom of the caramel-colored bottle made a clickety-clack sound against the solid wood bar.
Maybe it's time to go home, Mr. Marconi, Bill said.
There, I thought. He said it. My name. Jack Harrison Keeper Marconi. He knew who I was, just like everyone else probably knew who I was. Keeper Marconi. Former maximum security prison warden turned unemployed private investigator.
Tell you what, Bill went on, I'll call you a cab.
I'm pretty sure it was then, when Bill went for the phone, that I pulled out my Colt. Come to think of it, that's exactly when I got a good look at my sad face in the mirror behind the bar, pulled the piece out, and emptied the entire 8-round clip. Blowing away Jim Beam and Jack Daniels and even managing to nail some wild turkeys in the process. It was a damned shame, too, having to waste good booze like that. But I suppose, in the end, it would have been a worse shame to have wasted me. 2. The cops had to have been on their way before I decided to blow away my reflection in the mirror. Not those off-duty cops scamming free beer. But on the job cops in black uniforms who stood out in the white light of the aluminum and glass entryway, black 9mm automatics drawn and poised, combat position. But then, the cops came as no surprise. It was the sudden appearance of Tony Angelino that came as the real shocker. He stood square at the head of the pack, dressed in a camel hair overcoat and a blue blazer, just like mine. His dark gray slacks had been cut and tailored for his medium but stocky build. His white wedding carnation was still pinned to his lapel, and the wide-brimmed fedora on his head matched his threats.
to a T.
He wasn't smiling. Neither was I. How about a drink? I said. He just stood there, staring at me with those deep-set brown eyes of...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?